Welcome to another episode of Adoption, The Making of Me, an oral history of adoptee stories. I'm Sarah Reinhart.
And I'm Louise Brown. Make sure to find us on the socials at The Making of Me Podcast. Our website is adoptionthemakingofme.com.
Thank you.
Thanks.
On today's episode, we will be discussing Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood by Gretchen Sisson. And then we will be speaking to adoptee Chris. Hi, Louise.
Hey, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
I'm still like basking from our Patreon Zoom. It was so great.
So great. I love our Patreons.
I know.
The community is growing. I feel like we have such a group. I mean, I look forward to it. I wish it was.
I do too. Fun. It's like hanging out with friends. I mean, it is hanging out with friends. That's how I feel about it. So, all that said, if you listener want to join our Patreon Zooms monthly, our next one is May 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them what they have to do, Louise.
You go to patreon.com and sign up at the $10 level or above. If you go above, you can get a mug, you can get a t-shirt, but at the very least, the $10 level. We're not doing it the 4th because we have some plans, but the 11th is what day. And last time, Julie, one of our Patreons, gave us attachment styles. So this time we'll have a topic that we'll send you if you sign up.
Yes. And I was going to say something about the mug, which is we gave it to Jeff. Mm. You know, we talk about Jeff, S12F.
Yeah.
And he said it's his new favorite mug. So want to join Jeff in procuring a mug. It says another great episode on it.
That's right. It's fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, see you soon.
See you soon.
Hi again, Sarah.
Hi again, Louise. Here we are to talk about Relinquished by Gretchen Sisson. We are on chapter 1, The Domestic Suppliers of Infants.
It's just gross, that name even.
Thank you, Justice Alito. So this jumps back to, I like how she also said, we can't talk about current adoption without going back and talking about the history of adoption.
The history of adoption.
Right.
Which I have covered a lot.
Because between American Baby and The Baby Thief,
about
Georgia Tan, which she gets all into that. She starts out the gate with the Roe v. Wade, what legalized abortion in the first place.
You know, I didn't know about this. Maybe I did, but I don't remember knowing.
I'm trying to remember. I think I read an article about her, maybe even when she died. But anyway, yeah. So it was an anonymous. She was a Norma. This woman had been 1969. She'd already had two kids. She did not want to have another one, wanted to have an abortion. Her doctor wouldn't give her one. And so then she found these lawyers. And then, of course, she was really angry because it didn't pass till 4 years later. So she had to give up another baby for adoption.
She'd given up a second one because
her mother took it
and signed away her rights without her even realizing it. And she had all sorts of tragedies and things go on in her life. And then she said, of her many sorrows, giving away her children was by far the worst thing.
And she'd been through... She had an abusive father. She had a brutal childhood in poverty, an absent father, a violent mother, repeated sexual assault, ongoing domestic abuse, alcoholism and drug use. I mean, how do you overcome that stuff?
No.
She had no tools. And
and then she had to suffer on top of that. I mean, the loss of her children. And with all of that, even with sexual abuse, all of it, that's what she said.
The loss of her children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, I've highlighted so much, Gretchen.
Where do I even start? There's so much, Gretchen. Wow.
There's so much. During the Dobbs argument in 2022, Amy Coney Barrett postulated that requiring women to continue pregnancies was a negligible burden. In all 50 states, you can terminate parental rights by relinquishing a child. It seems to me that the choice more focused would be between, say, the ability to get an abortion at 23 weeks or the state requiring women to go to 15, 16 weeks more and then terminate parental rights at the conclusion. Like, what?
Well, this is just for adopters, really. That, I mean, none of this has anything to do with the best for the child, best for the adoptee, best for the kids.
Never. Well, you know, and then you get deeper into the book, and really at the end of the day, these conservative Christian organizations that are hijacking women's rights.
Other countries have closed their borders to adoption. All sorts of things have happened in that area, and we're low on babies.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants kids. Everybody wants a baby. And, you know, they're being slaves. Well, and then
so she gets into the history and, you know, going back to our earliest relinquishing mothers were enslaved Black women.
I was glad she got into that.
Yeah. I mean, just
half of all slave trade separated nuclear families and intentionally. There was a book, Life of the Slave Girl. I mean, they used to threaten the practice of separation incentivized a calloused indifference to the family relationships of enslaved people. And it would continue after the Civil War. Some families were not important. I mean, that's really, you know, it still comes down to, I'm sure she'll get into this more because she already is, but it comes down to poverty, class, where you're from, the money, you know, all of it. It's still true.
I did forget because this is the title of the chapter, and I don't I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the footnote from Alito, Justice Alito, citing a CDC prevention report. He implied that an increased availability of infants would in fact serve a broader social good. And here's where it comes in. The domestic supply of infants relinquished at birth or within the first month of life and available to be adopted has become virtually non-existent. That infuriates me beyond, I can't even, when you tell people that, people aren't really aware of that.
No. I remember when it happened, when we were doing this podcast, what blew up on Twitter, X or whatever, and everything that happened, it's like, I think the light bulb did go off for many people who were like, wait, because that was leaked, right?
So I guess my point is that when you tell people, you know, when you bring in the adoption aspect of it, to people who aren't in the adoption world that are like, oh, wow, that lands, you know.
It's a commodity. It's a product, right? Where babies are products. And
babies are products.
Gosh, I know. I'm glad.
And then in the same tradition of taking enslaved people's children than the Native American mothers, you know. I mean, it's just
what they went through and what they recently went through, even up until the 70s in Canada and the U.S. I mean, they were taking their babies and socializing them so that they
could assimilate
and take the Indian out of the Indian. That's how they said it back then. It's
right.
Disgusting.
Take the Indian out of the Indian. Unbelievable.
It's disgusting. And by that, and
I mean, and you're aware of all this. I've read all, you know, but it's just when it's all together, this condensed version of reading. This is another book, you know, that should be required reading. People don't want to know. I mean, thank God it's getting out there. People like Gretchen and Gabrielle and, you know, getting this stuff out there is so important. Gabrielle Glazer, I'm referring to.
Yes. She does get into Georgia Tan. She gets into, you know, most adoptions before that. Well, she does also do the baby train, the orphan train. You had a relative on the orphan trains.
Yeah, my stepmother had a relative on the orphan train. Yeah. And the baby farms,
they just become laborers. I mean, this was just this, some people, there was a woman, she cited that the woman had a child, her mother was in the hospital and they still took the child.
Right. We talked, I remember that from.
Me too. It was a big wake up call.
And then it was finally, you know, at the turn of the 20th century when people started realizing, oh, babies can make me happy, you know, like instead of thinking of them as, oh, just a mouth to feed and, you know, this actually is, you know, maybe I'll have some love in my life. And then this is where adoption took a turn.
And the media helped with that. The media made it family unit and how beautiful this is. And it was a whole, everything turned. And that's when
began. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was after? And then, of course, we get into, I highlighted this. Adopted people had only one legal identity, and it was as the children of their adoptive parents.
I have a big star, too. Yep. And it's still true. This is
interesting.
It's
still true.
This part. By the 1950s, a healthy baby would cost adopted parents up to $10,000. Yeah. I mean, so back, if you do inflation, that's got to be like 80 grand or something.
Well, I think that's where we're at now. Right? Isn't the going price of a baby around $80,000 now? Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah.
So here,
this is also where there's, you know, during the 1940s, not a single Black child was placed for agency adoption in Florida and Louisiana. Efforts to promote adopting to families of color were often fruitless, as Black parents were alienated from the process by income requirements, proof of infertility, and predominantly white agency staffs.
Another thing they got in, and she got into also, they were more into kinship. This is a thing,
right,
too.
Yeah.
The family stepped up more.
And there's less stigma in a Black community to be a single mom.
Yeah. And you help people. And that's how it should be in all communities. And then, of course, our era happened, the baby scoop era. How many? That's even just the numbers are sobering.
Staggering. How many?
I was
8 million. Yeah. Babies scooped up during the 1950s and 60s. Well, that talk saw the systematic removal of Native children reemerge. But there was some place.
Yeah, we talked to Chris Stearns about that, actually. That's what happened to him. He was on. Oh, here it is. This is interesting. International adoption in the United States doubled during the 1990s. But she talks about the numbers here. Here we go. 23,000 adoptions. You're right. We're at the peak. No.
The baby scoop era was millions.
Yeah, millions.
Millions of babies scooped up.
I don't know what the number is, but it was,
By the 90s, it had plummeted. And so then.
Yeah, they went into international.
Right. Then they started going. But in 1997, when Bill Clinton was president, this was a shameful thing.
Yes.
Congress passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which fast-tracked the termination of parental rights for families with children in foster care, which is still going on.
Yeah, that's still the uphill battle with, I mean, that's, yeah. It was interesting that that was in the Bill Clinton era as well. And, and then, so adoption because of abortion, honestly, and other choices for women, birth control, knowledge, sexual, you know, knowledge of how you get pregnant, everything else, you know, adoption drops a lot. For people. So what happens? International adoption.
Right.
Korea,
right.
China, here this, Guatemala, Haiti, Ethiopia, Russian.
So while international adoption in the United States remains extremely low now, right? Because the other countries are like, enough of this.
Yeah, they closed their borders.
Yeah, like that's it. Just, it says, and while international adoption into the United States remains extremely low, at times of crisis, it reemerges when there's a tsunami in the Indian Ocean, an earthquake in Haiti, or a war in Ukraine. American missionaries and nonprofit organizations routinely work to remove children, not just from danger, but from their families.
Yep.
Again, all in the name of God.
Yeah.
Oh, just, I don't want to be controversial on our podcast, but But really, we're getting into where we're at now. Right. Because
it was really interesting because she gets into the total history. I mean, everyone I think really should read this book because then now she's getting into who's having babies now and relinquishing them. Right. And I think you and I were talking to somebody recently who said, well, what if, I don't know if it was you and I or somebody I was talking to, and they said, well, what if you're a young mother and da da? Well, you're actually, it's not that many young mothers doing this, to be honest. That was an interesting.
Well, here, ultimately, knowing who relinquishing mothers are is only part of understanding contemporary adoption because so many ideas of adoption are not rooted in the experience of those who live it, but instead in the political, religious, and cultural narratives that we have about building families, caring for children, finding common ground in the abortion debate, and fulfilling a religious calling.
Yep.
Here we go. This is what I've been saying. Most adoption facilitators in the United States and around the world are closely affiliated with conservative churches and thus either by proxy or directly with the anti-abortion movement.
And then she does ask, so, you know, you get into who's relinquishing babies. 14% of the women in the sample were teenagers. 56% were in their 20s, which...
It's married women. Married, it's women with children.
Yeah.
Already who, and not poverty stricken. Like these are women who are having abortions. Sorry, I conflated what you were saying.
Go ahead.
The women who are having abortions are by and large, like people who already have children and have, it's just not at a good place in their life. It's not this image of
these, I know what the public thinks it is. And she does say then, Why are women relinquishing their babies? The answer is clear when we look at variables that speak to the financial resources. Most of them are unemployed. 64% reported less than $5,000 in personal annual income. And if we look at health insurance, 88% of relinquishing mothers have coverage from Medicaid. This proportion is twice the rate of the Medicaid coverage for all women who gave birth in the United States. I mean, she's getting into, you know, it comes down to we don't help the mother, but we pay a lot for someone to adopt a baby, but we don't help the mother.
Right. This is the ongoing narrative.
Yeah.
She talked to a historian. Sorry, we feel listeners, if we're being scattered, it was just a very dense chapter and
so much
to cover. And I know we can't cover everything, but this woman, Ricky Solinger, said, almost everybody believes that on some level, birth mothers make a choice to give their babies away. I argue that adoption is rarely about mothers' choices. It is instead about the abject choicelessness of some resourceless women.
Yeah. That's why I liked her title, actually, just in the privilege of American mother.
Right.
When I was reading it, it was, you know, I mean, like Sarah said, this chapter is dense and it's really, please read along with us. It's so important. I feel like I need to reread as well, you know, as we go. At the end of the chapter, she literally says this. Are we willing to withhold support for those families who are the most vulnerable? History has shown we are willing to go quite far in the name of supporting some families over others. I think that kind of comes down to like why we're all adopted in the first place, isn't it?
Yeah. And when once again, it's the one bipartisan, you know, Americans of all religions and political parties believe adoption to be a fundamentally necessary and social good. They see adoption as a way of ensuring better lives for children who might otherwise not have homes or parents at all. These beliefs are rarely rooted in reality.
Yeah. That's why we need these.
How
people,
loud like, can we scream? How, like, honestly, like, what will it take? I hope this book will make some movement. I hope there will be change.
I do just, too.
You know, and we've got a lot more to go. So
we sure do.
Gretchen, we hope we're doing you justice. We've got two chapters for next week, Cassie and Jordan, chapters 2 and 3. Cassie, or just actually, they're two short little stories. And then after,
then we'll tackle another big one,
another big chapter. So,
yeah, we do hope we're doing it justice because it's like at night when we're reading and this morning, my mind is just churning. And then you're like, what am I going to talk about with all of this? The whole thing is circled.
Yeah. You know what might be a good thing to do? Yeah. Something to think about is maybe in our show notes, we start putting some statistics.
Yeah.
So anybody that comes across the podcast and they're scrolling through to see it, they can see the stats.
Good idea.
So
yeah, we will work on that.
Let's just get this out there. People need to know.
Yeah. And this is a great, this book really has she has a lot of information. She did 10 years of research on this.
Yeah, so. I know. I mean, thank you, Gretchen. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, now we have a great guest, Chris.
Yes, Chris. Okay, we'll see you in a minute.
See you in a minute.
Hello. Today we have someone coming to us from Sierra Madre, California. Chris Valdheims, welcome. Happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. So much. And this is your first time telling your story on a podcast.
It is. Yeah, I've told it in other places and mentioned it, but yeah, the first time really getting into it. So really looking forward to that.
Yeah, getting out there. So we know a little bit, but tell us your story, how you'd like to tell it from the beginning.
Usually where I start is I was adopted when I was 7. So as an adoptee, I was older, meaning that I grew up with my mother for the first few years, and then I was in foster care for a few years. So my adoption story is different in that I remember my mother. You know, that's the only family member I really actually remember. So then I went into adoption, wasn't really any contact with my family. So I kind of had this thing where I remembered my initial family, like, you know, in terms of like conscious memory, right? But, you know, it's in this new family. And I'm like, well, kind of, who am I? Where do I fit in? So it was kind of, you know, and I think that's, you know, maybe a common theme.
Was the family that adopted you, had you been in foster care with them?
No. So I was in foster care with a different family. And then I was adopted out of foster care with them when I was 7.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm 7, so I already kind of have a little bit of an identity and, you know.
And a name. And did you keep that name? Is this your name that you were born and raised with?
Yeah, so this is Chris Valdheims is the name I was born with.
Okay.
My name was actually changed, though.
At seven?
Went by a different name. Yeah, at seven.
Oh.
Different gosh. Name until about almost 2 years ago when I changed. I'm almost 47. So it took me until I was age 45 to decide to change my name. Like, and I'd wanted to for a long time, but that was like, for me, a big part of, it was like a, really a catalyst. Like, it was like a resolution of a lot of stuff, but then also like a catalyst towards, okay, I can like fully reclaim my identity in a sense.
At 7 years old, it's mm-hmm. just unbelievable to me.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where when it happened, it was kind of like normal because I didn't know anything else. I didn't know right. that it wasn't a thing.
Right.
Oh, okay. I guess I'm going to change.
A thing people are doing.
Right. I'm like, okay, I guess that's just what you do. Like, I didn't have any point of reference. But I remember growing up and I would introduce myself by my adopted name. And I'd be like, I always felt like I was not lying, but like,
that's not
me. Not being real. You know, I'd always be like, hi, you know, my name is John Tobin, which is my name. And I'm like, but inside, I'm like, that's not really my name, but I'll use it for now. And I went through adulthood with that feeling. And when I change it back, I'm like, oh yeah, this is my name. This is who I am.
Yeah. That's another layer of
another level. Yeah.
Another level.
We were just talking to somebody before about, you know, in, I don't know if you ever read The Primal Wound by Nancy Verrier, but she talks about the adoptee splitting into good and bad. And somebody we were talking to a little while ago said, actually, she thinks it's the adoptive parents that do the splitting. This is another example
back, yes.
of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's weird because I try to think back to the time, you know, and I want to understand the motivations. I don't want to just sort of be like, well, they were, you know, there was ill intention or anything.
Right,
like.
Right.
Even, I didn't even want to say ignorance, but I want to say maybe we had, not as much understanding as we do today. Like, I think doing that today, you'd really have to be like very willful about, no, I'm going to do this to this person. Whereas, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like in the 80s, the people just didn't really give it much consideration. They're just like, oh yeah, you're in a new family, change your name. It'll be great. You know?
Chris, we're hoping that they're giving it more consideration now, honestly.
Certainly maybe on the outside, there would be a lot of pushback these days. You're right, that because things are highlighted. Identity mm-hmm. is strongly mm-hmm. highlighted.
I would hope so.
Now when it's not, but who knows what, you know, those yeah. other stuff that replaces that, you know, that's yeah. equally as insidious.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you say that you were with your mother?
Until I was five. But then when I was in foster care, we'd have visits. So
you'd have visits.
We would have visits and stuff like that. So yeah, so I remember living with her. Like, I actually have memories of having a room and, you know, being in an apartment with her and all this other stuff, you know, and I have memories of her. So that's, you know, for me, that's a big difference. I think, you know, I have six adopted brothers and sisters who were adopted when they were babies. And so that was like, for me, that actually felt like a huge difference between me and them mm-hmm. because the adopted family was the only family they ever knew. You know, they're all adopted like weeks old, months old. And so they didn't have that, but I always felt like I was kind of this, you know, outcast, even in the adopted, among the adopted kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I remember my family and I'm not really, I didn't ever feel like I'm fully.
You have this new name and like, yeah. and you, yeah. there were seven of you in the house?
Seven.
It was just seven adopted kids.
That's right.
Were there any yeah. biological kids there?
No biological kids. So seven adopted kids.
Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a religious family?
A little bit. Like they were religious, kind of. So. It wasn't like super religious, but like they, you know, the adopted mother was Catholic, practicing Catholic, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then my adopted father at some point became like quasi-evangelical, I think. At some point when I was like, okay, this is different, you know.
When they took you into their yeah. family, when they adopted you as a seven-year-old, were you the youngest of the whole
yeah, I was wondering.
Clan? Like, what were the circumstances in which they came to adopt for the first time, not a baby?
Yeah, so they already had three adopted kids, one of whom was older, and then two who are younger. So I came in the family as the second oldest.
Oh, okay.
And then more were adopted later. So three more were adopted after I was adopted.
Was it a kind situation?
Yeah, I was wondering.
You mean like overall?
Yeah.
It's hard to say, but not really. I really felt like I can't wait to get out of this.
Mm.
So it wasn't great. You know, there was a lot of issues, including like substance abuse issues. And I was just like, this place is crazy, you know? I really try to be compassionate to people now and be like, you know, everyone's trying their best, but, you know, also my experience is my experience. So that's,
right.
That's what it is.
Of course. And then you, yeah.
Having seven adoptees in one house, there's some stuff going on there anyway, mm-hmm. with if no one's addressing issues. And was there open discussion about any of this? Or
it was weird because it was one of those things where, like, the thing that would be said is, we're here to talk about anything that you want. But really, like, if it ever got into, like, I want to know more about my family or this or that, everybody's story kind of ended up being the same. Mm-hmm. But your parents had problems. They couldn't take care of you. And that was kind of...
Yeah, we're here to hear anything.
The running theme.
To right, a
we're,
point.
We're here for anything. Yeah, we're here for anything. But if you really want to know stuff...
We're not here for...
Stop asking, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Or it's like, you know, like, about my mother.
Accept my answers.
Right. except the things I really want to know about. Yeah. That's... So it wasn't, you know, I think the overwhelming theme was, you know, and you probably heard this from a lot of people already, like, we're a family. And it was very much about, like, we're a family, like, where are your family now, like, kind of thing. And
yeah,
it was almost like any attempt to learn more about yourself or differentiate yourself was sort of seen as a threat.
Yeah, taking away from the family.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've gotten past that. You know, I think to varying degrees, people in the family have accepted or not accepted that kind of narrative. And we all have our own journeys on how we are dealing with it.
And you keep up with some of your siblings that were adopted with you?
Yeah, it's actually one of the great things in my life that's come out of that is having my relationships with these siblings. Like, we're all different people. And I think as adults, it's really nice to see how everybody's kind of gone in their own direction, but we have this thing in common. And we get together for holidays. Oh. And, you know, we get together for birthdays and different events. And
you have your own adoptee community, honestly.
I do. Yeah, I do. I really like that. And, like, it's one of those things that as I get older and older, and as we have kids and stuff, it just gets better and better.
So first 5 years with your mother, is she in your life now? And what was the path? From so she, 7 years old, and, like, what was your path?
Yeah, so she passed away in 1995.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, right when I turned 18, which was kind of annoying, to say the least.
So often we hear these things, right? Yeah. Right at critical points.
Yeah, right. And I don't think I even understood yet. Like, I don't think I was even in the moment when I was 18 to be like, oh, now I'm 18, so I can go and, like, reconnect with my mother. Like, I could have found her, like, I kind of knew generally where she was. Like, she lived in New York, and I kind of generally had a sense of where she was. And then, you know, of course, with the internet, it would have been, like, which was just kind of starting then, it would have been easy to find her. So anyway, like, I didn't have contact with her, but she was sending letters to me. You know,
were you getting the letters?
I wasn't receiving the letters.
Oh.
So I would get paraphrased bits of the letters, like,
so,
oh,
someone they'd screen your letters.
Yeah, so yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. But what happened was, one time in high school, I think this was in 1992 or 1991, I happened to be home to check the mail. You know, like, I was homesick or something, and I went and checked the mail, and there was a letter from her. And so that was the first time I actually was able to read a letter from her unfiltered.
Gosh, and you don't know at 18. I mean, come on, it's
no, I had no idea.
You can't go, oh, I'm 18. I have all this perspective. That's not how. No. Being 18 is no, gosh,
yeah, or not even perspective on being an adoptee. Like, for me, it was kind of, and this was maybe the theme going into adulthood, was almost denying the fact that I had this experience of being adopted and just trying to be normal,
right? Yeah,
and be like, okay, well, it's not that big a deal, I can just kind of push through it. That was, you know, the idea, until I was like, no, this isn't really working the way I want it to.
Yeah, what started you thinking about all of this? I'm curious.
Having kids.
That seems to be the impetus for many of us.
Yeah. I mean, I'd always been searching. So I think, you know, especially as the internet got better and I could start searching for stuff, I would. And this was maybe like early 2000s. So even before like 23andMe or Ancestry or anything like that came about, I was curious. It's more just like, what happened to my mom?
Did you not know that she died until you started this search?
So I was told that she died. And so it was kind of this weird thing where I was told that she died in 1995, right? So, you know, I graduated high school. I was going to college, and it was like, your mother passed away.
Who told you this?
My adoptive mom.
Okay.
So I talked to my mother on a payphone. You know, I called her. I was given a number, and I called her, and I talked to her. So I did have one chance to talk to her at that time. And then, yeah, I told she passed away. But then what was really weird, and so it was actually kind of it was unresolved for a long time, because after that, you know, I was able to search, you know, at some point, like they put like death records and stuff like that online. And I wasn't able to find her for a long, long time. I found my grandmother. I had an uncle. I found him. But I couldn't find her for a long time. And then randomly on some site, I found like some little record of it. And so I actually, for a while, I thought that I was being lied to. Mm. I thought that she was still alive. And because I turned 8, because someone had told me, I talked with this woman who was like, well, you know, sometimes adoptive parents, they'll say that your parents have died so that you don't reconnect with them when you turn 18. So I thought that's what had happened for like years.
Oh, that's confusing. Do you know anything about your father, your birth father, your first father?
Yeah. So it's weird. So in 2006, and this was a time when I was really trying to like reestablish relationship with my adoptive mother. We're watching a documentary on the Challenger explosion. This was like the 20-year anniversary or something.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, hey, did I ever tell you about your father? And I'm like, nope. She's like, well, he might have been one of the astronauts on the Challenger. So if you look up Ron McNair, he's one of the astronauts. I mean, mm-hmm. I haven't, you know, and this is why I don't really talk about adoptive stuff, because this is something I'm just feeling comfortable talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Like recently. I actually had a friend, one of my grandfather's friends, my biological grandfather's friends, he's an older guy. And he said to me recently, and I was like, yeah, you know what? You're kind of right. He's like, you continuing to hide this does nothing for you. And that's, I'm like, right. Okay.
It doesn't serve you at all.
Yeah. He totally just said it like straight up, you know, like he's very no nonsense. And so.
Have you done your DNA to know that that's your father?
I've not done DNA, but the thing is, you know, in some of the letters that my mother sent me, she mentioned him in a lot of ways. And when you put together all the things that she said, like pretty certain, because she's like, oh, your father is a physicist who got his degree from MIT. He's mm-hmm. a musician. You know, he, all this other stuff, which that's all that he was, you know, he was those things. If you look up, you'll see. So, you know, it's been really weird because I'm like, I want to connect with the family, but because he's someone who's well known, it just feels kind of weird. But I'm at the point now where I'm kind of tired of trying to, you know, figure out.
Yeah, and you don't know that they won't be thrilled. You don't know, right?
Right.
It could go either way, but they could also be like, he's gone. Mm-hmm. And look at you to get to know you.
Yeah. It's definitely for sure she knew him. So she worked at MIT. My mom worked at MIT.
Where were you born? Were you born in California?
I was born in New York. I was born in Grantsville, New York.
Oh.
Yeah.
At the hospital in on 7th Avenue? Yeah.
Yep. 1977. So, you know, I tell people I was born kind of in like the craziest year in New York history.
That's no kidding.
Blackout, to the summer of Sam, and all that stuff. I'm like, I came in right in the middle, right in the thick of things.
Right in the village. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where was your adoptive family? Were you
in
New York, or how did you make it out to California? Or so then are they just the whole family?
So we went to Boston. So first, you know, I was living in New York, I think, for about a year. Then my mother and I moved to Boston, Cambridge, where, you know, my mom was working. And then, you know, I was in foster care when I was 5. And then, so that's where I connected with my adoptive family, is in Boston.
That's where you were kind of raised. And then California's adult life?
No, then we moved to California.
Oh, okay.
With a stop for a few years in Chicago, and then we moved to California. My adoptive dad was a radio DJ. So he was like, you know, when we lived in Chicago, that was probably the peak of his career. He was like the morning announcer, like one of the radio stations in Chicago. So like, I'd go with him to the radio station and all this other kind of stuff. And he was cool. But like I said, you know, there were substance abuse issues. And at one point, you know, he left the family, and we were kind of screwed. This was like when I was in high school.
Another abandonment.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like, I tell people I've lost multiple mothers, multiple fathers. Mm. It's a mess. And so it took me a long time to kind of emotionally untangle.
Sure. Yeah. This is your journey and your search. So you know this, but we all do it as adoptees, right? Like, I feel bad, or I shouldn't contact. Right. But you know what? Yes, you should, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. And I think the more that I lean into that, you know, it's taking ownership of the story, I think, is really a theme in my life right now, is like taking ownership of the story and not really making it sub to someone else's story.
Right.
You know, being like, this is my story. And if it makes you feel a certain way, it's really out of my hands. I can't.
Which is so often the case. I mean, you know, you're really coming to this full force. I think about your mother, you know, having you and moving around and writing those letters that you're not getting. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, she must have been heartbroken.
Yeah, I think she was. I think it was really rough on her. She was Latvian and was a refugee from World War II. So I think she already had a lot of stuff going on from that. So yeah, I can only imagine what she went through. And I do.
Did you have good memories of the time you spent together? And like, yeah. I mean, I guess one thing that you might have that people who were relinquished at birth is that maybe you've had a bond with her early on and maybe gave you a certain foundation and strength that kind of carried you through all that stuff, having that early bond.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot she was able to teach me. You know, she even taught me to read before I was five. You know, she was a very, very smart person. And she taught me to read. Like, we'd go to museums. Like, she'd take me out to restaurants and, like, shows. And I remember all this stuff. Like, we'd go to places. We'd do things. And, yeah, I think she just... Yeah.
It's tremendous. You know, you have children, we have children. And when you think about it in a different context, like your children, right? Mm-hmm. It's heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah, the moment I've had a number of times, I don't know if either of you have felt this, but like there are times and, you know, honestly, I've been able to do okay for myself and my family. Like, and I'm really grateful for that. And there are times when I look at, like, this is when my son was seven. And that was like the time, like for me, the hard time when I was being adopted and in foster care. And I like just kind of teared up because I was like, he's okay. Like he's not going to go through that.
I just think why change, you know, I know people do and did crazy things changing names, but I mean, even your first name, it's so, you know, 7 years being Chris and then you're John. Yeah. It's very.
it was weird. And I didn't realize how much it affected me until.
I'm sure.
Even as an adult, like I kind of denied the fact that it was that important, but I would always have a hard time introducing myself. And it was weird because it kind of made me really introverted in a sense, more than I wanted to be, more than I think I was or am naturally. Like, because I always have this moment of awkwardness where I'm introducing myself, but not feeling like I'm introducing my actual self.
Right. Yeah. So you said you just went back to your name 2 years ago. How has that been in your life? Like with your kids and your partner, or like, how has that been in professional life? And
everything.
So it's been amazing. The thing that surprised me the most is obviously my partner, she's just like, yeah, of course, let's go. You know, because she knew kind of that whole scenario. And I mentioned it to her over the years. And at some point I did it. So, of course, she was like immediate right there. The second kind of round was to my adoptive brothers and sisters. They were all super supportive. They're all like, yep, that's it. I remember I sent a text. I think I even screenshotted the text thread where I told them. And I'm like, hey, this is my name now. Or I sent them a video, right? I sent them a video and text. And they're all like, yep, just change the name in my contacts. You're like, that's it. Done. And so they all kind of knew. Like, yeah.
I love that you have that group. I mean, that's really just to have them is huge.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. And it actually brought me closer. You know, I think it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, I can be the real me with you guys, you know, instead of this version of myself that I was kind of forced to be growing up that wasn't me.
And honestly, you might be helping them because they were adopted at birth, right? So they have more of the narrative that we grew up with of now they can say, hey, wait a second.
Right. You know. Right. And then, you know, that's what I always hope. I mean, I don't want to push anybody to anything they don't want to do, but I hope is if the more that I can do anything in general, you know, the more that I can show stuff about myself and the more I can be vulnerable and do this stuff, I hope that that's an example for people who are called to do anything like what I've done.
Yeah.
And did your adoptive parents, how did that land?
I don't really communicate with them. So it didn't land, you know,
doesn't need to land, to be honest with you, you know, it's like, hello.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like,
what's your name?
You know, and it's one of those things where it's not like any kind of animosity. It's just, it hasn't been helpful in my life to have a relationship with them, you know, in terms of like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've heard the story, you know, from multiple people. Just, you know, again, I try not to make it anything where I'm like, I'm not angry at them. I'm just like, it's not, you know, thanks for what you did and I'm going to go on, you know.
There's even the having to say thank you.
As soon as I said that, I'm like,
yeah. I gotta give you some pushback on
we
that.
We all do.
Figuring it out. Yeah.
We all do these things, don't we?
You get it though. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally get it. But also what I just got to is just how strong the indoctrination is when you're adopted, you know, just it's really, really hard to get away from that thinking and narrative. And, you know, it's like deculting.
Kind of, right?
It is, really.
Yeah, which is why I think I've had to keep distance. You know, again, it's not like I'm angry, like, screw you guys. But it is like, if I want to be who I am and feel like I'm safe doing that, I do need to have distance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just the way it is, you know, and it's how I feel.
Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, I really get it. So do you have any thoughts about doing a DNA test?
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah,
I think about it a lot because, you know, who knows who's out there?
Mm-hmm. Cousins and...
Cousins. Yeah. And I think on either side of my family, there, you know, there could be
siblings
people that I don't know or who I could connect with. On my mother's side of the family, all the immediate family is gone. And I know this, like they're all pretty much.
Oh, she didn't have siblings.
So she had a brother passed away. Her parents, my grandparents passed away. And, you know, we emigrated here, but there's people. And so I've actually had an interesting experience. So I told you her side is from Latvia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Gone to Latvia, and I've actually connected with people there who are like distant, and they found me actually.
Oh,
yeah, I have relatives who are Russians in Russia, and we've met in Latvia. Like, so they kind of had a parallel story to me, in that they, you know, instead of coming to US, their parents went to Russia, and they grew up there, and like they're like another generation removed.
That's really neat for you to have that.
Yeah.
Wow. And do you keep up with them?
Yeah, we send like, we're on like, Telegram, we'll send pictures every now and then.
That's what I mean. Like on your father's side, it doesn't matter who he is. I think you should claim that and try. And maybe with him being gone, there'll even be excitement about it.
Yeah.
To know you.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because, you know, if you do the math, you know, he was already married when he was with my mother. So it's also kind of like, I don't, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable, but whatever.
I have an uncomfortable situation myself, but then Sarah reminds me, it's, you know, we're the children.
Right.
We didn't create the uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And hopefully then, you know, there's a little more evolution in the next generations hey, that happened. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
How old are your kids?
14 and 10.
Oh, you're busy.
Two boys. Yeah. Yeah. And they're great. And it's, you know, I think, you know, for me to really be able to bring this back, it's, or, you know, to kind of, so that they know, you know, and it's interesting being a parent who's an adopted person and then thinking about how does this affect my children?
Mm-hmm. Which is something so strange. When I had my son, I'm not going to speak for Sarah, but I didn't think about me being adopted, how that would affect mothering or.
I don't know how we could think about it, but if you're still in the fog,
but you really
so affects, to speak, how do you. Yeah. Think about it. Like,
and it affects your children. It's strange that we don't think about it, but we don't. It depends on your journey.
Again, the indoctrination. Yes. It isn't strange. We were indoctrinated into a mindset as adopted people. So, of course, it didn't affect our lives in any way but the positive until you start seeing the truth.
And some people come into it. We've had a guest recently came into it quite young before she had her children. And then you see the difference how you can... You know, you parent differently or what you would say or what you're saying to them. Like now I'm doing the catch up, right? Like we have a podcast. I'm sure my son's like, oh, this is all very interesting. And I can have the real conversations, but he's 26, you know, right. 25, almost 26. So it's so, you know, your kids are still young where you can talk to them and really it's because they're affected too. It's a generational thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. I think it's funny. The place where the conversation has happened in the past is when they get assigned a family tree project in school or something.
Yeah, right.
I have a podcast I do on the side. And I think I at one point talked about like family tree projects. And I'm like, for a while, that was kind of this really fraught thing. You know, it was kind of before I got, you know, fully like invested in, okay, this is who I am and this is who we are. And it was always this question of, oh, you put the adoptive family, you put the birth family. I'm like, no, absolutely the birth family. Here's who you're. Grandfather was, who's here, who your grandmother was, et cetera. Like being very clear about that.
That whole project's a strange thing, isn't it? I used to teach middle school and being an adoptee, I actually was very conscious about that. Like I never had it to put on my family tree. I remember when I was little getting kind of in trouble for it. Like not, you know, the teacher I had wasn't great. And it was it can be an awkward thing for kids. Mm-hmm. So many kids from so many different situations too. And just that's yeah. when you're like, wait a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny you brought that up.
Yeah.
They're still doing that in schools?
Yes. Yes, yeah. they are. Yes, they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. And I think, I don't know why, but yeah, it does happen.
Education's catching up too, isn't it? Or not.
So now you're in your journey and you're thinking you might do the DNA test and complete the cycle. Wow. And you said you're moving.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm moving to Croatia. This is happening in June. And that's where my wife's family is from. So
okay.
I mentioned to you both, I'm, you know, pretty much I've lived in LA since I was 11. So
it's a big move.
A big move, especially because we're moving to a village of 400 people.
Oh, whoa.
You have to keep us up to date.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be sharing about it. You know, I'm trying to get better about sharing on social media. I can't be bothered most of the time, but I think it's going to be interesting for people. So I will probably try to do better there.
And how are your kids feeling about that?
Mixed. I think on one hand, you know, like they're going to miss their friends and kind of all this stuff. I mean, they're LA kids completely, you know?
Right.
But also, I think they like it because we've got, you know, the place where we're going, we've been going there ever, their whole lives. You know? There's like a little village where my wife's family comes from. And so, you know, they have a whole friend group and whole community there that we're part of. And so that's valuable. And they like being there. So it's half and half.
Yeah.
Half and half. It's not fully like, yay, we're going to move to Croatia. And it's, but it's also not like, oh, this sucks. We're moving to Croatia. It's like,
right.
So,
well, will you stay in touch with us and let us know what happens?
Yes.
Like when you do your DNA and all that. Very, very curious.
I feel like we need several updates from you coming up.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like I actually spent, I'd say started in 2009 when I really delved into my mother's side of the family, because it was very strange how the whole thing happened. And so now, like, and I kind of came to a resolution on that. And like the resolution ended up with me changing my name back, right? So that, you know, mm-hmm. spoiler alert, that's the end of this, not the end of the story, but the end of
the chapter.
The whole chapter. Yeah. So the next chapter I know is kind of, how do I connect with my father's side of the family?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like this other reunion experience because they're alive. And so for my mother's side of the family, everybody had passed away. So it's all like secondhand information.
Right.
You know, it's all these people who knew them or...
I have that.
Anecdotal stuff.
Yeah.
More anecdote. Yeah.
I have that with my mother. She died very young. And so I only have the anecdotal side of it. I don't have any real... But I do have a living father. He's the last... And that's a strange thing, right?
Yeah.
It's a whole nother dive.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a whole different thing. So, I think that's the thing that I'm going to be pursuing in the next few years is how to do that. The way I came across my mother's side, one of the interesting things I talk about is the art that you see behind me.
Yeah. I noticed that art.
Mm-hmm.
It's created by my grandfather, my biological grandfather.
And wow.
Lived in Montreal. And he created over 600 pieces of artwork like this. Like this is the original, one of the originals.
Wow.
So he was like a hermit. So they, like I told you, they came to America, North America, from Latvia.
After
World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that whole thing is what kind of led to me being adopted in foster care, like their kind of struggles with that. But his reaction was, all right, the world is screwed up. I'm going to try to figure out what it all means. And so he basically became a hermit for 50 years, created this artwork. He had this one friend in Montreal, who's like a younger guy, who's now in his like 70s. And my grandfather would be over 100 now. So I found this guy on the internet. So I was searching one night and I found him on the internet. And I'm like, hey, because he made a website about my grandfather, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, if you go and you'll see it's online. And I'm like, hey, I think that's my grandfather, you know? And it's like a random discovery. So I connect with him and he's like, yeah, I have all his stuff. I have all his journals. I have all his documents. I have all his books. I have all his artwork. Basically, everything that was in his apartment. This guy has a room in his house, pretty much devoted to my grandfather.
That's incredible that you were able to find him. And and what a rich discovery. And you're the only heir to that, really, aren't you?
How grounding. It's like,
yeah. So that's what kicked off. Like, and it was crazy because that's when my older son, you know, my wife was pregnant with my older son. So that's when I really was like, okay, I need to figure this out.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I find was like this whole thing and, you know, his whole journey. And he's actually like, you know, is an artist that was, the standard thing of the artist isn't really known during their life. But right. then decades after they pass, like, you know, art institutions are like, oh, wait a second, we didn't know about this guy. So he actually has had museum shows in a variety of museums, and he has stuff that's going to the Centre Pompidou in France yeah. and all this kind of stuff. So the art world is like, oh, wait, hold on. Who's this? What? We didn't know about this guy.
How yeah. neat.
So let's watch that happen.
That is just, what a great story.
Yeah.
Are either of your kids artistic? I'm just curious.
Yeah. It's funny. My older son is, yeah, like a pretty devoted artist.
Uh-huh. You know,
his room, he's into graffiti art now. So his room yeah. looks like a subway from the 80s. It's just like,
well, his dad was born in the village. I mean, yeah, after all, like,
that's right.
He picked it all up. I never really even encouraged him. I'm just like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I see you.
Comes out of naturally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, this is really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, great. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us your story and getting to meet you. It's been really interesting and
eye-opening.
Wonderful. Really, yeah, it really is.
Well, thanks for having me on here.
Please keep us posted. I'll definitely
encourage
you to
Links in case you do some things about Croatia that people might want to watch.
Yeah, but Croatia and this other stuff, you know, I was telling you, I'm really just kind of learning how to tell this story. Like, you know, YouTube have given me the space to start. So I really appreciate it. Yeah.
No, I'm glad you found us and came on. And thank you. Thanks for sharing with us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, very much. Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care. Well, that was fascinating. I'm just sort of in awe of him. The art and where he's going and how he's intentionally taken back his name.
I was just going to say that. That's brave to do that, you know. It's nice to have a supportive partner who really is open to that, and that all of his siblings that he grew up with.
That's what I was going to say. Community. We always say about community, and I'm sure we talked to someone earlier in our weeks that has no community, and you're like, it's so healing. Mm-hmm. He has a built-in community. I was glad to hear that.
I know. You know, that it was not a contentious situation where they are supportive. And because, I mean, that could go either way. You've got 7 adoptive kids. You know, it could have been a bad situation of feeling competitive and, you know, you feeling on your own. And it wasn't that way. So that's,
I feel like he's a trailblazer in his group.
Yeah.
And a neat guy. What do we say? Another great episode. See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening today.
And remember, if you'd like to share your stories or suggest any guests for our show, you can find us on all the socials at The Making of Me Podcast.
And again, we have a Patreon page so that we can continue to bring these great adoption stories to you. So if you want to find that and donate or contribute in any way, find us at patreon.com. Searching adoption: The Making of Me.
Bye.
See you next time.